Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week, giving you a chance to catch up, ponder, or reconsider. On Monday, January 4th, Alan and Joe welcomed Cohoes City Director of Operations Teresa Bourgeois, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson.
What does the panel think of this? Nancy Pelosi was reelected. There were some questions of wondering whether she would be and whether her seat was safe. But she was reelected House Speaker, and among the surging pandemic, the new Congress has convened, and the final vote was 216 for Pelosi, 209 for Kevin McCarthy. And of course, Democrats are poised to have the slimmest House majority of either party in 20 years, beginning the session with a 222 to 211 advantage.
Well, I actually learned something. I'm sure you all did, too. Sarah, you're our lawyer in the group. But I learned that you could be speaker without being a member of the House. Did you guys know that?
I didn't know that.
That was in the paper today. Somebody voted for a senator. The newspaper explained.
Oh, Tammy Duckworth. They voted for Tammy Duckworth. Yeah.
Right,
okay.
Right.
All right. I didn't make that connection. Yes. Okay.
Right. And then there was a parenthetical: you can be speaker without being a member of the House.
Oh, that's interesting.
What I found interesting about her, it's always tough to be in a last term, and she's made it clear it's her last term. People, don't pay adherence to your instructions quite the same way they do if you thought to be there forever and ever. So there is that. She is 80 years old. I believe that's correct.
Correct.
She'll be 84 when she's out. 82, I'm sorry, when she's out. That's a fair age. The fact that a couple of people decided that they're gonna vote against her, I don't know what that meant, but maybe they think it's going to help them politically. I just don't know.
She was supported by the so-called squad. She was supported by the majority of the Democrats, and we can only assume that most thought what I think many Democrats thought, which was maybe now's not the time to screw around with the with the Speaker of the House.
Yeah, the squad has not been polling well lately.
Like,
and maybe
that's
part of it.
Today, as they said in the movie Airplane, maybe today was not the day to give up sniffing airplane glue. Maybe today is not the day to change your House Speaker.
Which is true.
I mean, I'm glad the squad voted for her. This is not a time for division and infighting. Especially if we end up controlling the Senate, we all need to work together and reverse what's been done in the last 4 years. And if we have both houses and the presidency, we can do that. But if people decide that, oh no, well, we've got this, but I want to go even further and further to the left, we will lose in the midterms and we will lose the House. People need to recognize that what sells in New York City or sells on either coast, right, is not necessarily going to sell in the middle of the country.
Yeah.
And I take it, Libby, that when you say we, you're talking about yourself right here.
Yes.
Because
the editorial we
doesn't edit.
The editorial we, but the Democrats. The Democrats.
Go ahead, Teresa.
The other thing that she did yesterday was announce that she's creating this bipartisan select committee on economic disparity and fairness and growth, which I thought was very good, that they're going to focus like a laser beam on economic inequality. And you see that with a lot of the Biden appointments, and she's reinforcing that message with this group. And I do think it's also a tool to help bring together people who are, disaffected in her caucus. And I think that will be both helpful and important.
Right.
Sarah?
I disagree with everybody, but that's all right.
With me?
Shocking.
I do.
Well, I want you to articulate that.
There's a lot to unravel here when you talk about poverty policy, when you talk about what liberal democracy really means, when we talk about not chasing back to the middle and in fear of doing the right thing. And I'm not saying that's what anyone is espousing here, but that's, I hear a lot, you know, when I hear we're going to focus on economic disparity, that's fine. There's nothing facially and, you know, wrong with that. That should be done. And systemic injustices that go beyond the neoliberal economic structure, right? Like, I don't think that if Nancy Pelosi, if the party made a decision to go with, let's call it bold new leadership, at this time, that would have been an equally legitimate choice. And I don't think Nancy would just like hide in her office and be like, all right, good luck. You know, good luck with the position. She cares about the party. She cares about America. She cares about her state. She cares about our democracy. She would help that person grow into the role. And so, I don't know. I get my feathers ruffled when we start equating things to, you know, low polling numbers for the squad. Polling of who? And who are you talking to? I guess I feel a little bit of a responsibility to lift up the voices of young people and progressive Democrats that I've been listening to over the course of this presidential, and just offer that alternative view and say that we can do both. It's yes and. It's not like if we do that, then everything's going to fall apart and we're going to lose, right? Like, we can grow this party together and make sure that all voices are included in that process without losing thousands and thousands of votes. It's all sure. about the message.
Sure. And the Republicans.
He is a progressive Democrat.
Yes, she is.
And she is a progressive Democrat, and it's the moderates who voted present. So, I mean, she is that voice. She's been that voice for a long, long, long time. But she also knows how to build a coalition to not just talk about policy, but actually to get it enacted. And that's what we need right now.
And historically, in 2 years, we're going to see another election, right, for the House.
Mm-hmm.
And Teresa, perhaps you want to tell everybody what happens usually when you have an incumbent president and what happens in the House of Representatives.
That the Republicans win.
That's right.
You need to guard against that, and you need to get as much done in the next 2 years. So it's fine for, you know, Bernie and all this talking, but you have to actually, to make a difference in people's lives, you have to actually enact legislation. And right now, there is no other person who has the skills that she has and has emerged as that leader. But you got to bet that she's helping that person, is trying to groom that person.
And as I say, Republican McCarthy didn't lose a single Republican vote.
I appreciate all that, and I don't disagree with anything that was said in that segment. I'm just saying that we need to give, it sounds like we're going back to giving short shrift to what I would say is a new progressive Democrat that's not relating to Nancy Pelosi.
That's
well, the cat, well, that well cat you got won. The cat vote.
Well, the cat came back.
Interestingly, I think this is what's going on with the Labor Secretary nomination, which is exactly that fight that they're having internally about who gets the job. I mean, this is probably way too wonkish, but this fight is who is the right voice to deal with these economic inequality issues. But if you can get through a major infrastructure bill, which will not only help communities but also put people back to work, if you can put together a clean energy bill, which is as much a jobs bill as it is a clean energy bill, address climate issue, and it puts people to work, you know, that's the success that you need to have, and make some improvements in healthcare.
Well, and there's also, you know, learning from our past and not doing the exact same thing. Running to the center hasn't helped us win. And by us, I mean Democrats. But, you know, there's an opportunity here to reshape the voice. Joe Biden had to do it as part of his presidential campaign, and it worked spectacularly well. So there's just a lot of opportunity here, and I want to make sure that the fear that has loomed over us for the last 4 years doesn't impede the potential progress that we might be able to make over the next four.
All right.
And there are 122 women in the Congress, which is astoundingly exciting. Sorry, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
And there's more gay LGBT members and people of color than ever before.
Let's talk about the about Georgia, the next 24 hours and what that's going to be. Both candidates we mentioned will have rallies. One, the Democrats will have Joe Biden participating. The Republicans will have the president participating. And so where do these last hours bring us, do you think? And I'm not sure we really touched on the issue of what the news of the last 48 hours, of what impact that has. Alan, would you like to?
I knew you were going to call on me. The answer is I don't know. I have no idea whatsoever. I do know that there are a lot of things to be considered here, one of which is the people of Georgia voted against Trump. That was... to my mind, satisfactory, as Nero Wolfe, the detective, used to say. On the other hand, they have shown no propensity not to support other Republicans. So I just don't know where their heads are and whether or not Trump's nonsense will stop them from turning out. There are those people, CNN keeps running headlines, and others who think it will. But, I just don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I listened to Governor Kemp on Fox last night, and
Georgia Governor
looked exhausted.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Georgia Governor Kemp, and he was working as hard as he possibly could to get off the topic of the Trump call and onto the topic of the election, and he looked beyond exasperated by the conversation. You've got to believe it will dampen their vote a bit. Voter turnout will be the key. But again, my concern is, will this then make people doubt the outcome of the Georgia election as well? And that will be, if it's close and the Democrats win, will they use this to create questions about the validity of the win? That's deeply concerning.
Excuse me. And do you still have the Secretary of State and the governor in the same position that they are now on ensuring the integrity of the vote, or trying in some way? And I'm not accusing them of this, but just raising the question of trying to save face by allowing some of the perhaps the recall recounts and so forth to go on.
It was interesting to me in the interview that one thing that he did say is, when I took the oath of office, I swore to allegiance to the Constitution. And if he keeps doing that, then we'll stay on track.
Oh, we'll try. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Will the public believe it? That's the problem. Will people believe it?
Yeah. Sarah, go ahead.
The officials in Georgia know that all eyes are on them.
Yes.
They know. They have to be on good behavior. Their papers have to be excellent. I wouldn't be surprised if they aren't staffing up, if they aren't giving their campaign workers stern reminders of their constitutional obligations. This may be the most secure election in the history of the state of Georgia.
I was so struck by what you just said before, which was, that there are more women in the House, there are more people of color in the House and the rest of it. I've always believed, and I've been saying for months and months now, that that's what this whole thing is all about. There is a group of people in this country, and we can call them Republicans because mainly they are, who don't want to transfer power. They don't want people who are gay, people who are black, people who are Hispanic, taking over their country. This is the way they've always had it. And so the fact that it's paying off now and it's actually happening is proof positive to me that they knew what they were talking about and that this is really going to be a transformational election.
Alan Chartok on the Roundtable panel on Monday, January 4th. This is Roundtable Panel, the Week in Review. I'm producer Sarah LaDuke. On Wednesday, January 6th, the show started with a discussion about the results from the runoff Senate elections in Georgia. Joe and Alan were joined by UAlbany Adjunct Professor Rosemary Armeo, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and Director of the Franklin D. Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum, Paul Sparrow. This was Paul's first time as a roundtable panelist.
Paul, I thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to welcome you to our club here.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to be a part of this astute panel, and today is a day that will go down in history. There's no question about that.
Well, and it already was a day that had history, which is one of the reasons before we knew all this was going to happen, why I asked you to be on the show today, because it's the 80th anniversary of FDR's Four Freedoms speech. So it seemed like a good day to have you on, and now it seems like a really, really good idea to have you on.
Well, certainly the Four Freedoms seem as relevant today as they ever did, and I'd be happy to talk about that more later on.
Absolutely. Well, Paul, welcome to the program. I thank you very much for being with us and look forward to your insights. So, well, let's get through it. First of all, what we know right now is that the race has been called for Reverend Raphael Warnock. And the race has not yet been called for John Ossoff. However, a short time ago, he did declare victory. All signs point to a victory for him. And as numbers are released throughout this morning, at least were expected to be released, we would think that he will be declared the winner. So if that is true, it was a really big night for Joe Biden. His chances of signing ambitious legislation to fight climate change, reduce economic inequality, and slow the coronavirus pandemic, it's a big job, and it got really big. But he now will have, most likely, a Democratic Senate by the slimmest of margins, 50-50 with Kamala Harris as the tiebreaker. The Democrats appear to have won both Senate runoffs in Georgia, giving them control of the Senate. The Reverend Raphael Warnock has beaten Senator Kelly Loeffler by about 2 percentage points. Most news organizations have not yet called the race between John Ossoff and David Perdue, but Ossoff leads by about 16,000 votes, and the outstanding votes come from Democratic-leading areas. We should note that if that lead holds up, it is about the lead, give or take, about the lead that Joe Biden won the state with against Donald Trump. Nate Cohn, who analyzes election results for the New York Times, said he believed Ossoff would likely end up with a lead of more than 0.5 percentage points, large enough to avoid a recount. David Wasserman of the Cook Political Report wrote that he considered both races to be over. The apparent victories will give Democrats control of both the White House and both houses of Congress for the first time in a decade. A Senate majority will make a profound difference to the Biden administration and will be able to pass budget bills and confirm judges, neither of which tend to be vulnerable to filibusters, so as long as Democrats remain united. But it is a slim margin. That narrowness will mean that Democrats will rarely be able to overcome a filibuster and will often be reliant on their most moderate senators, like Joe Manchin of West Virginia. But still, there is a lot for the Democrats to be happy about this morning. Meanwhile, we will also keep our eyes on and talk about in a few minutes the other huge story today, which is the fact that they are meeting in they're meeting on Capitol Hill today to certify the election. And where is that going? And what is the president of the United States? What will happen? We know that he had a long conversation with Vice President Mike Pence yesterday. We are told that conversation did not go terrifically well because Mike Pence told him that he really had very little power. But Congress will meet today to certify the Electoral College results. And with that pressure on Pence, who will preside over the ceremony to overturn the result, but Pence has said he does not have that power, but he will not, he said, quote, remain a wallflower either. So we'll see what all of that means. But we go to Georgia first. And Alan, some takeaways, do you think, for you, the takeaways from from Georgia, assuming that the Ossoff victory is assured. What do you make of it?
Okay, so what happened is, you know, the Democrats had a tough slog, and they did what they had to do. They had turnout, and that may mean a lot for the country. You know, the African American turnout was apparently stupendous. And there is not only that, but there is a growing idea that, you know, people can have their say and have their vote and that they will count. Now, you know, I'm looking at Pence and I'm saying to myself, if there's a single person I'd rather not be in general, it's Mike Pence. But also, he is now in a very tough spot.
Rochelle in the role of mother.
There's no way this guy can be president of the United States. That's my view. But here is the biggest bully that we have developed in this country, a guy who wants to, you know, basically take away our democratic freedoms, who is leaning on Pence, who is a weak man to begin with. Now, I suspect when he says, I won't be quiet either, or whatever he said, it means he's going to do what he has to do, but he'll say, but I don't like it. And I do believe the president is right that there have been problems. That's my bet about what we're going to see today. But I've been sitting here thinking, what would I do if I were Chuck Schumer right now? And, you know, the president of the Senate, somebody called me yesterday and said, you know, it's the vice president, not the president of the Senate who's in charge. I said, no, you don't get it. You don't get it right. The vice president is the president of the Senate. Most people don't know that. That's why Mitch McConnell is a majority leader, not the president of the Senate. In any case, what we have now is a situation where if I were Chuck Schumer, I'd stand up and I would try if Pence did rule against them and say, well, no, Trump is elected president of the United States the way I see it. I would call for some kind of a vote within the Congress. But I don't think it'll get there. I think Pence is not stupid enough to break the law.
Rosemary Armeo, your thoughts.
So I've been thinking about the implications of this. And again, the assumption is that both seats will go Democratic. Chuck Schumer has more power than he did before. And I suspect he'll be his lack of force, which made him, and I didn't think a very good minority leader, might serve him better as a majority leader. He also is in the same mold as Biden. So you have to look at what happens when Senates are so evenly divided as they would be either way, no matter who wins this time. And I can see him doing a sort of, let's all get along thing, splitting up chairmanships, trying to play nice with the Republicans. And I do think that that would be a mistake. McConnell knows all about gumming up the works as a minority leader. He's the sort of minority leader I wish Schumer had been. And it is not going to be easy, even with this win. And much, much, much easier having won those seats. But still, this is not a sleigh ride from here on out. So that's the main thing that I've been thinking about, but also just the implications of this. No more worries over cabinet seats being approved. No more worry about judgeships being held up if, in fact, the Democrats can hold their unity. And so, again, that's a huge job for Chuck Schumer.
And remember that in 2 years, Rosemary, there's going to be another election. And there are a lot of senators up for office, and the Democrats really can't afford to have the usual circular firing squad and to do each other in. This is a time, I suspect we're not going to see it, but this is a time for unity.
Paul Sparrow, what do you make of this?
Your turn to talk, Paul.
I'll try to bring a historical perspective to our conversation today, and I would just like to make a direct connection between a great leader and one of my personal heroes, John Lewis, and the election, because, you know, John Lewis, great civil rights icon, fought for voting rights back in the 60s, March on Washington, became a congressman, and really fought for the people of Georgia. And, of course, there's a direct connection with both Ossoff and Warnock. Warnock was his pastor, and Ossoff was on his staff. And I believe the final votes coming in, putting them over the top, came from Congressman Lewis's former district. So I think you have a remarkable development here where we're seeing efforts that are 50 years old coming to fruition in a state that had been, you know, essentially Republican since, I guess, 1992, and that John Lewis gets credit for it.
Bob Griffin.
Yeah, Paul, welcome. It's an honor to be on the show with you. You know, a couple names that haven't popped up yet, and I think we're remiss by not raising them, is Stacey Abrams. Certainly, I think the work that Stacey Abrams has done, and honestly, I think this is a roadmap for other states, and I'm thinking specifically of Wisconsin, showing how important voting is, but also as this idea of voting as a block and actually regaining power is to me part of the message that's coming out of Georgia. You know, we talked about Schumer a little bit, Joe. I would imagine that he's doing a couple things. He's taking a couple Advil, a couple coffee, and he's probably also reaching out to some of the more moderate Republicans to build a coalition, because it is such a razor thin majority. It's still a majority, and that is incredible. But we do need a functional Senate, and you know, as we celebrate the election, as we celebrate what I think is a done deal with the Electoral College, despite all of the garbage coming out of Trump and his supporters, I just want to remind everybody, last night we had 3,775 deaths from COVID. And, you know, this country is racked with an unprecedented pandemic and crisis that really requires much better leadership than what we've seen from the federal government. With that said, it's a great day.
You know, it's one thing that came out in the exit polls, Bob, of people when they were talking about the issues, that they felt the two Democratic candidates, by huge margins, were much more equipped to address the pandemic, which people thought was paramount and a number one issue. And that that differed slightly from even just 2 months ago during the general election. So that's fascinating to note.
Yeah, that's a really interesting pickup, because I did see that with some of the exit poll data, and I thought that was really interesting too. And it does show that the COVID crisis is continuing to permeate everything that's going on in the country.
One last thing, Joe, if I may say really quickly. It's going to be fascinating to watch those Republicans who have been protected by Mitch McConnell, who won't bring stuff up for votes. Now, clearly, there are going to be a lot of votes that McConnell has been avoiding all along. It's going to be fascinating to watch the moderate Republicans who may be left and see whether or not they have the guts to say no. I'll bet they don't.
Alan Chartok on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, January 6th. Please note as you listen, any given topic's details and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more after this. Welcome back to Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm producer Sarah LaDuke. On Thursday, January 7th, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue began to process a coup d'etat with panelists, investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, Peabody and Emmy award-winning journalist Linda Ellerbe, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany Robert Griffin, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and the Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Hendler, and counterterrorism expert and best-selling author, Malcolm Nance.
Yesterday was a hell of a day. I don't think there's any other way to describe it and try to make it's probably difficult to even describe, you know, to find the right words to say what happened yesterday. Other than, I mean, there are words, of course, but, you know, without using, you have to say mob and you have to say sedition and it is inciting a riot. And we have questions of the 25th Amendment and whether we should impeach the president. Is any of that possible? We are told that actual conversations are happening on Capitol Hill. Is it at all hard to believe that that this cabinet will turn around and say that the president is not fit to serve the office? It I don't know. So here's what we know right now. A woman shot by police inside the Capitol during the mayhem has died. Washington police said that three other people also died in the area around the Capitol yesterday from medical emergencies. The president this morning said that there would be an orderly transition. We were later told by reporting done by Washington Post and other sources that was not to try to quell violence, that was more to try to stop the people who are leaving his administration and to stop the number of resignations that he has received. We also know that a pipe bomb was found at the Republican National Committee in Washington. Officials discovered a suspicious package nearby at the Democratic National Committee and evacuated it yesterday. If you are looking for the president's remarks on Twitter or Facebook, you will not find them. They have temporarily locked the president's account. Yes, the president of the United States of America, his social media has been turned off after he had issued statements that mixed praise for the rioters while telling them it was time to go home and said, "I love you and you are special people." Of course, there is the question about the police. They appeared unprepared for the onslaught. How did they get in? Trump loyalists had discussed openly on social media, Gab, Parler, other places. Malcolm, I know you're well aware of this, and we'll talk to you about that in a second. Trump initially rebuffed requests to send the National Guard to the Capitol. Who eventually approved the order? It was Mike Pence. Derek Evans, a newly elected Republican state lawmaker from West Virginia, was part of the crowd that rushed into the Capitol. So think about that. And after everything that happened, after all that happened yesterday, after the bloodshed, after the attack on the Capitol of the United States of America, still, with people like Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell pleading with senators, Republican senators, to withdraw their objections in light of what had happened earlier in the day. Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and others continued to say that the election was rigged. So with all of that and a lot to talk about this morning, Alan, we'll go to you and then we'll work our way around the room.
That's very nice of you, Joe. I appreciate it. But I'd like to pass to Malcolm. I can't wait to hear what he has to say. Malcolm?
Malcolm, you're up.
Well, it's simple. Yesterday was a catastrophe, but it was a catastrophe that was organized, planned, and executed by Donald Trump. This is where this was always going. Many of us have been on this program for months predicting that something like this would happen, that Donald Trump would mobilize and kick off what I call an insurgency against the United States. So much so that I've written an entire book about it that's going to be announced today. So, and believe me, I never wanted to write another book about Donald Trump ever again. But now what we have is essentially a man who is deranged and believes that he is a president in exile who has had his presidency stolen from him, and he mobilized what was estimated to be 40 to 50,000 people on the Mall yesterday. And because I do monitor right-wing extremist communications and their chat rooms and Parler, I was watching live as some of the first extremists were live streaming from his speech. And as soon as he said, we're going to go up to the Capitol and we're going to show people what to do, that's when they started moving in mass towards the Capitol. My analysis yesterday from their own video feeds were, there was an interesting mix, but the overall number of people that went there were below 40, which leads me to believe that there was a leading edge of Proud Boys, Boogaloo Boys, and other extremists in their not usual body armor, carrying, you know, without weapons, who were actually the militant edge of this attack. The problem is when they went to the west side of the Capitol, they were met with very severe force by the Capitol Hill police. It's when the protesters went around to the north side and came in through the east doorway that it appears that they may have had cooperation with people in Capitol Hill police. Joe Scarborough this morning put it right when he said, we need to investigate whether there was a fifth column of sympathizers within Capitol Hill police who treated them like a tour group, let them into the building, fell back and let them do what they wanted to do. The shooting is regrettable. I'm not going to judge the person, even though I've seen her videos. She was radical, but I'm just amazed there weren't more shootings. This has shown terrorist enemies you can get right into the Capitol with enough effort. What I didn't understand on the Capitol Hill Police's tactics, and I went through SWAT officer school with Capitol Hill Police, I didn't understand why they didn't assume that within that large crowd, there may have been a nucleus of real terrorists who may have designed to kidnap or barricade themselves or capture and execute lawmakers on the gibbet, the noose that they erected on Capitol Hill yesterday. I don't know if you've seen the photograph of it, but there was a real new setup outside the Capitol.
There was.
So it's an absolute disgrace, and it is a complete failure of national security. Everyone in Capitol Hill Police, from senior management to middle management, needs to be summarily fired, then investigated.
Bob, what do you think as far as certainly the security concerns?
I think Malcolm is spot on. Joe, you don't negotiate with cancer. You can't debate with cancer. You can't ignore cancer. This cancer must be identified and cleansed. I believe strongly that this was an inside job, that there was collusion at some degree with folks both inside the Capitol and outside the Capitol. This is a coup, okay? This is a coup. And Malcolm, I saw a picture that you had on your site with one of the one of the insurrectionists carrying the twist ties that are used to incarcerate people. And what that tells me is that they were going in looking for hostages, that they expected to take hostages. This wasn't. Yep. This was an attempt to overthrow the United States government. Article 25 mm-hmm. should happen today. Trump should not have an opportunity to pardon himself, his criminal children, or anybody involved in this attempted coup. That a commission should be set up immediately with subpoena powers and rip through everything that's involved in this situation, including following the money and the money that funded not only the coup attempt, but the senators and Congress people who also enabled this. So we should be looking at AT&T. We should be looking at Berkshire Hathaway. We should be looking at UPS. We should be looking at the money that went in to orchestrate this coup. It's a coup.
We have many, many letters already saying that Malcolm and Alan are right. They've been warning us it could come to this. Now is the time for them to say, I told you so. We also have many letters about the Capitol Police saying that they need a thorough investigation. Sue says they are there to keep order, not take selfies with rioters destroying government property. Corinne writes to us and says, I stood up to shout shame in the U.S. Senate gallery to protest passage of the 96 welfare reform bill, and Capitol Police dragged me by my hair over several auditorium seats and arrested me. There's no way anyone, let alone the police, was unprepared for what happened yesterday. Linda, you were talking about, I think you wanted to comment about the officers and the selfies. Yeah, that was a disturbing picture.
Yeah,
one of many.
I don't want to generalize here because I did see in video yesterday Capitol Police doing their jobs inside the Capitol and trying to stop things. Yes, I saw the video of the selfie being taken. Yes, I did see a video in which you see the backs of Capitol Police and the rioters in front of them, and you see them just talking to them from the back. You see their backs. And then you see them stop, let the crowd through, and the Capitol cops just walk away. They're not running. They're not under duress. It looks complicit. Not saying it is. I want to know why Stephen Sund has a job this morning. He is head of the Capitol Police. None of this could have been a surprise. I confess, I don't have a lot of respect for the Capitol Police because I covered the Congress for several years, and they were not, at that time at least, good or even real policemen. Their major job is a doorman. They belong to the Congress. The Congress is in charge of them. They report to no one else but the Congress, unless I'm mistaken upon that. And all day yesterday on television, you saw both members of the House and Senate and reporters talking about our brave and wonderful Capitol Police, our wonderful people, the Capitol Police. And I had to wonder myself, how much is this you really thinking they're wonderful, and how much is this you knowing how much they can mess with your life while you're just trying to get around and do your job in that building,
right,
or any of those buildings on that hill?
Many media members.
Why does Stephen Sund have a job this morning? Why haven't I heard of his name?
It's a great question, and you know, besides all of this, and Rosemary, I want to get to your thoughts, but, you know, getting into the Capitol, okay, one thing, but how in the name of God did they get to within feet of the Vice President of the United States, not to mention to the floor of the House and to the floor of the Senate? Rosemary, go ahead.
Okay, so my thoughts are all over the place. I've been up all night watching TV. I'm just I'm consumed by this. I want to say about the police, I thought from the minute I saw that swarm get into one of the supposedly most secure buildings in the entire world with ease, that it had to be an inside job or that there was some major sympathy among the police in there, the law enforcement in there with the operators. And that is the hallmark of a coup in every other country that I've ever been in. So I worry about that. Linda, you're absolutely right. Heads need to roll. And I think that starts with the head of the police and goes right up to Trump. My abiding image of last night was when at 8 o'clock Congress finally reconvenes. It was so freaking normal. It was like they just went on with it. There was not a mention of Trump and what he did. We got some scattered reports that the cabinet was kind of thinking about the 25th Amendment. He needs to be. I hope his. I have no trust that they do. But what ought to be happening is that Republicans are going to him as they did to Nixon and say, "Sir, you need to resign right away." I think the 25th Amendment is going to be too hard to actually happen. I think also Congress needs to impeach, not because that does any good right now, but to keep him from ever running again. I think this was what we saw yesterday was appalling and cannot stand as it is. Here are my other thoughts. Bill Barr, why did he leave? Did he know something like this was coming? The Capitol, as you know, is not under the city of Washington's jurisdiction, but really under federal control.
Right.
And DOJ had a part to play. There is, Malcolm, you probably know more about this and can talk about it. I'd love to hear about it. Why the National Guard had to be called in by Pence, not Trump. Where is the acting, whatever he is, the Attorney General? I feel like we are a banana republic. I heard yesterday from people, from friends in Africa and Eastern Europe, who recognized this for what it was, a coup for which we were woefully unprepared and shockingly shocked by it. Alan and Malcolm have been talking about this for months, for weeks on the, almost to a distraction on our show. And yet national commentators yesterday were saying, oh, my God, you could hear their shock and amazement when they were reporting what they were seeing. Why did they feel that way? Next, I want to know what our lovely new attorney general is thinking about prosecuting members of the mob and about Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump, who fomented this action yesterday. Inciting to riot is a crime, so why are there not charges?
Rosemary Armeo on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, January 7th. We'll be back with more Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm producer Sarah LaDuke. On Friday, January 8th, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue were joined by former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, Siena College economics professor Aaron Pasitti, and Albany County District Attorney David Soares.
All right, everybody, let's go. Here's what we have before us this morning. The top Democrats, the top congressional Democrats, are demanding Trump's removal from power as the fallout continues from Wednesday's siege of the Capitol. Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senator Chuck Schumer said the Democrats were prepared to impeach Trump a second time, but with less than 2 weeks until the end of the president's term, it is unclear whether Democrats could move quickly enough to do so. Several Trump administration officials have resigned over the violence at the Capitol, most notably Betsy DeVos, the Education Secretary, Elaine Chao, the Transportation Secretary. The Justice Department has not ruled out pursuing charges against the president for his possible role in inciting the mob. We are looking at all actors, not only people who went into the building, according to the U.S. Attorney in Washington, Michael Sherwin. Trump has suggested to aides that he wants to pardon himself in the final days of his presidency. No president has pardoned himself before, and legal scholars are divided about whether the courts would recognize it. Meanwhile, in a video on Twitter, Trump did not give up his false claims of election fraud, but finally conceded defeat. Facebook is blocking Trump's account at least until the end of his term, with Mark Zuckerberg saying, "We believe the risks of allowing the president to continue to use our service during this period are simply too great." The president has returned to Twitter. That 12-hour block has been lifted. Meanwhile, the investigation continues. The chief of the Capitol Police and the sergeant-at-arms for the House and Senate announced their resignations. The Capitol Police turned down support from the National Guard before Wednesday and rebuffed help from the FBI as the mob descended. Brian Sicknick was a Capitol police officer. He died from his injuries as a result of what happened. A portrait is taking shape of the woman who died in the rampage. And there were, who was there? Well, we know that there were white nationalists, conspiracy theorists, many anonymous, but many not, who have very, very large social media profiles. And those are the rioters who rampaged the halls of Congress on Wednesday. So, again, not to overstate the obvious, but it's been a hell of a week. So let's go and talk about where we are right now with the U.S. dealing with this cascade of crises during the wait between a presidential election and an inauguration. Alan.
I have to say that despite, you know, the fact that the district attorney is always not nice to me, I've been waiting to talk to him about this because, as we all know, this has now become a very interesting question of jurisprudence and of also of, you know, prosecution. What are we going to do here to this president? And here you have people who have been bullied all along, been scared to death. All of a sudden, they're coming out and they're saying all kinds of things. Now, I could go on for the next, you know, hour and a half, but I want to pass, if I can, to David Soares, who I really want to hear from as to what some of the prosecution, you know, aspects of this might be. David?
And before you answer that, David, let me just ask, did I miss a show? When did you, when were you saying mean things to Alan? What were you mean to him?
Earlier.
1989.
Earlier. Never forget. Never forget.
You mean to him? All right,
yeah,
go ahead.
He was talking about my toes. Don't you remember? It wasn't that long ago. He was making fun of my frozen toes.
Why? Okay.
Well, I think it might have been the frozen toes or the time that your device that lends assistance to your hearing was stolen by crows. But Well, so look, this is what we have here. I mean, if we're talking about the president of the United States, there's only three ways. There's only three ways that within the next several weeks, this president could be removed. One is through, of course, articles of impeachment, which would then require the trial in the Senate. I think we've lived through that, and I think that we're all understanding that. You know, between now and the next several weeks, there's just no time to achieve his removal through impeachment. Now, I think they should bring articles of impeachment because symbolically, I think that that is certainly important, right? The other issue is the other way you can remove this person is through the 25th Amendment. But the 25th Amendment requires that you have the cooperation of Vice President Pence. And, you know, that's just not going to happen. There are two ways by which Vice President Pence could trigger his removal. Of course, one we're very familiar with. It's bringing the cabinet together and getting a majority vote from the cabinet. That cabinet seems to be emptying out faster than my dessert cabinet at home with people stepping aside. So I don't see that happening, and someone would have to wake up Wilbur Ross in order to get him to vote one way or the other. The second way that the
dab the drool and
trigger that. The second way that the 25th Amendment could usher, you know, his removal is through creating what's called that body in Congress. Now, what's interesting here is that in October of this year, Nancy Pelosi had recommended creating the body. Now, the Constitution doesn't really spell out what that body is, but it's really people appointed by Congress to evaluate the health, the mental health, and the abilities of the president, and then decide to remove him. But in order to create that body, you would also have to have the cooperation of the vice president. And again, Nancy Pelosi, during the stimulus discussions back in October, after hearing and reading some of the tweets from the president, had proposed a bill to create exactly the body that we're now all talking about and contemplating. It was called the Commission on Presidential Capacity to Discharge the Powers and Duties of the Office. And the third way, of course, is through resignation. And I don't think there is a likelihood that that is going to happen. Of course, now, Alan, as you discussed, we're talking about possible charges that moving forward, you know, the president could be charged with. You know, there are civil disordered charges, the obstruction of governmental administration charges, there's inciting a riot, there's seditious conspiracy. And I think we're, over the course of the next several weeks, we're going to be hearing a lot of that. We're going to be hearing words like treason. We're going to be hearing words like insurrection. Those are all possible offenses that could be contemplated should there be
a Department of Justice official that is interested in pursuing that course of action. And then once we're done talking about that, we can talk about whether or not the president can self-pardon. There's a lot of dispute with constitutional authority within constitutional circles as to whether or not that could happen. I have some opinions, and we'll talk about that.
You know, go ahead.
Joe, if I may, for 1 second. David, I want to follow up with you. You mentioned the idea that there were people resigning from the cabinet. They're getting out of the way because the 25th Amendment involves them. And the last thing that Elaine Chao and others, I suspect, want to be involved in is having to vote on or speak on the removal of the president. Am I right? I mean, in other words,
you could say
they were resigning because they were admonishing him, or you could say they want to just get the hell out of there because they don't want to be involved in this thing.
The thought right now amongst all of our Republican Party leadership is 2024. That's what everyone is looking towards right now. This has been an unmitigated failure, disaster. It has been the American carnage that he predicted back when he took the oath of office. But I think right now the play for Pence is wanting to distance himself as much as possible, because I think he believes that 4 years is all it's going to take for Americans to remember that he was part of this, and he aided and abetted the insanity that's taken place in this country over the course of the last 4 years. And the same thing with Mitch McConnell.
Judah, thank.
Well, David laid it out beautifully. I think there are going to be books, endless books and movies on his what he just presented in the last few minutes. But on one hand, the president absolutely must be held accountable for provoking this riot, this mob, this riotous mob. You know, I went back and looked at the speech he gave at that rally at the White House. And, you know, he told these people, go to the Capitol and I will go with you. Of course, he didn't go with them, but he told them to do this. And I think the reason is because he knew that it was not going to permanently block the certification of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. But I read that he was trying to put 11th hour pressure on Pence, that this would somehow inspire Pence to do something that is not legally able to do by blocking certification. Mm. So he holds real responsibility here. But, you know, 12 days before he leaves office, I don't think the 25th Amendment is going to be viable because Pence is not going to cooperate. And I don't think Congress is really going to get their act together. I mean, I hope I'm wrong. I just read that 200 members of Congress have called for Trump's removal. Now, in that 200, it doesn't mean that they're all going to vote for impeachment. So, you know, I think what I saw yesterday with Pelosi and Schumer, I was pleased that they were calling for Trump's removal, but I think they made a tactical error by saying, if they don't invoke the 25th Amendment, then we're going to move on impeachment. I mean, that's, you know, like a parent scolding a child. If you don't do this, I'm going to come back there. They just out of the gate should have moved on impeachment.
Judah Thank on the Roundtable panel on Friday, January 8th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable or via podcast. You may contact the show, roundtable@wamc.org. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke.
I disagree with everybody.